In ancient times, stories were memorized. This is why many of the ancient stories are poems, because the poetic forms help you to know if you're reciting the words correctly, preserving epic poems like the Iliad and the Odyssey from generation to generation. Then writing came along, and the Greek philosophers were concerned that this new technology would rot the minds of the youth. They feared that people would lose the ability to memorize long works like the Iliad, word for word. As Socrates once said, if men learn this writing, it will implant forgetfulness in their souls. They will cease to exercise memory because they rely on that which is written, calling things to remembrance no longer from within themselves, but by means of external marks. But writing took off anyway. In fact, it is through writing that we can still hear Socrates' criticisms of writing today. And yet, was Socrates wrong? As the number of books grew, the ability to memorize the Iliad was slowly lost. Today, people struggle to memorize seven-digit phone numbers. The Romans later used their vast wealth to employ hundreds of scribes to create proto-publishing houses. Books became common and something that people could read for fun. No longer the domain of scholars, Roman patricians had libraries of books in their houses. The population of Rome was so literate they even had graffiti, some of which is still visible today in Pompeii. The Romans also invented the codex, which cut the scrolls up into pages and bound them together into a book, making it much easier to store and transport long works. Now, the whole Bible could be carried by a single monk on a single horse from one part of the empire to another. Then, 1,000 years later, the printing press came along, and it was better than an army of scribes at duplicating books. The combination of the printing press, cheaper paper, and the codex led to an explosion of writing that set Europe on fire. Books could not only be inexpensively created, they could be smuggled. But something important to point out is that the printing press didn't make the writing any easier. Drafting books was still done with a feather and inkpot. Almost no one wrote directly with a printing press. Type is reversed when you look at it, making drafting on a press almost impossible. Benjamin Franklin is the only author I know of who composed directly onto a printing press, and this was because he was a professional printer who knew his way around type. That, and he was a genius who didn't care that his straight-to-press writing was often riddled with typos. Franklin cared more about scooping the competition than about quality, especially as a young man. So, while duplicating and transporting books got easier, the writing process was more or less the same as it was for those Greek authors Socrates disapproved of. Authors were still scratching away rough drafts with a feather and inkpot. Then everything changed when the typewriter came along. The typewriter is older than you might think. To give you an idea, the typewriter is 80 years older than a commercially viable ballpoint pen. Many authors went straight from quill and inkpot to typewriters. And with the typewriter, authors could write faster and more legibly. The typewriter made writing so easy it moved from the domain of scholars and aristocrats to one of the middle class. The number of people writing books and the number of books published both rose. I can't imagine this went over well with the authors using the old system. Now the aristocrats and scholars had to compete with a horde of new middle-class authors. These authors will flood the market with low-quality books, they must have complained. And you know what? That is what happened. The typewriter combined with another new invention, the paperback book, to create an explosion of quickly written and cheaply made pulp fiction. Scholars and aristocrats still wrote, quote, quality, unquote, while the new middle-class authors could write pulp. But eventually, even the scholars and aristocrats switched to using the typewriter, too. The typewriter became an iconic tool of authors in the 19th and 20th century. In fact, if you search for an author on a stock photo site today, you will find photo after photo of people wearing hats sitting in front of typewriters. Then, everything changed again with the advent of the word processor and dot matrix printer. Word processors allowed authors to quickly make edits. They also had rudimentary AI-powered spell checkers to find and correct typos. The dot matrix printer allowed copies to be printed off in minutes. Word processors brought about two massive changes. They made the writing of the book easier, causing the number of new books to explode again. But they also changed how books were written. No longer were authors thinking through every sentence as they dipped their quill in the pot of ink to write four more words before pausing to dip their quill for more ink. Now, authors could skip the outlining process altogether and jump straight into writing a crummy first draft with the full intention of editing it later into a masterpiece. So, did the word processor make writing better? I don't think so. Did it make writing worse? I don't think so either. Authors write masterpieces with word processors, and there is also a lot of dreck saved as my book, Final Version 6, .doc. It can be easy to have a distorted view of books from the past if we only look at those that survived. Most books fail to pass the test of time, and they go forgotten and unread. The one change that I would say that the word processor brought about is that it made writing faster, easier, and more accessible to more people. Over time, the AI spell checkers improved and added grammar checking. They added copy editing, and authors became more aware of the technology that makes their word processor work. AI. Yes, the scary AI. But it's important to remember that word processors had AI from the beginning. I remember Microsoft Word's Clippy hounding me about gender-inclusive pronouns back in the 1990s when I enabled all of the features. Each year, AI gets more advanced. A decade ago, it could suggest the next word. Now it can suggest the next paragraph. Culture is having a moral panic over AI. So before we can go on, we need to ask an important question. Is AI evil? This is a fair question, and it's an important one. So let's take a step back and ask a simpler question as we work our way to, is AI evil? And that question is, was the printing press evil? The printing press allowed the dissemination of the Communist Manifesto, leading to the spread of communism, an ideology that killed more people in one century than all of the religions across all of time combined. For some comparison, roughly 150,000 people died in the Spanish Inquisition over a century and a half. Compare that to 1 million who died in the Cambodian killing fields in just a few years, or the 100 million who died under Soviet and Chinese communism. The poisonous ideology of communism could not have spread without the mass production of Lenin's Communist Manifesto and Mao's Red Book. So, is the printing press to blame for the horrors of communism? No. Humans have eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. We are the ones who know right from wrong and have both the will and the ability to do evil. Humans built the printing presses. Humans wrote the books and distributed the books. The printing press is no more to blame than the trees that went into the paper. Fundamentally, AI is still a human creation. Humans program the machine learning algorithms. Humans select the data sets for the large language models. Humans write and tweak the queries that the large language models process. AI has not eaten of the tree of knowledge. It has no will. Humans love to blame their evil actions on their tools, and this is nothing new. Evil people blame their evil on tools all the time. It wasn't me, officer. It was the bullet that came out of my gun. Evil requires a will, and AI has no more will than a knife or a gun. AI is a human creation, so AI cannot be evil. So why are you unsatisfied with this answer? It's because, is AI evil, is not really the question deep within our hearts. The real question we want to know the answer to is AI safe? This is, sadly, easier to answer, and the answer is no. AI is no more safe than a knife or a gun. You see, while AI can't be evil, people can be evil, and they can use AI as a tool to advance evil. Just like evil people use the printing press to advance communism and Nazism, people will use AI for evil ends as well. But people can also use the printing press for good. Sure, the printing press printed Hitler's Mein Kampf, but it also printed the Bible and Principia Mathematica and countless other books that have helped people over the centuries. All a tool does is allow us to do more good and more evil. If good people ignore AI, they will give all of the power of AI to those who will use it to do evil. Those evil people may even use AI to amplify the voices of people saying that AI is evil in order to scare good people away from AI. As we like to say in Texas, the only thing that can stop a bad man with a gun is a good man with a gun. Do you really want only bad men to have guns? Do you really want only evil corporations to use AI? Knowing that AI is a powerful tool, it behooves us to understand how it works and how to use it to do good in the world. So, how do you use AI for good? Find out in this episode of Novel Marketing, the longest-running book marketing podcast in the world. I'm Thomas Umstead Jr., CEO of Author Media, and this is the show for writers who want to build their platforms, sell more books, and make a living writing books worth talking about. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast by clicking follow in the podcast app on your phone. And if you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe. I think this is the latest in an episode I've ever done an intro. And we'll talk about both the good and the bad that can be done with AI. So let's start with talking about how AI makes writing easier. Like the typewriter and the word processor, AI democratizes writing, making it easier for more people to write. And the first way that it can help is with outlining. AI can help you generate an outline for your novel. Subtext.app is an intelligent outliner built specifically for authors. You can input the theme of your book, such as Decadence Destroys Society from Within, and Subtext will generate a story outline for each scene following the hero's journey or some other outline template that you select. The AI-generated outline doesn't replace you. You still need to guide the outline. But like a power tool, Subtext removes some of the hard work. To use this tool, though, you'll need to understand the fundamentals of story structure and have a message or theme in mind that you want to convey in your story. AI can also help you with brainstorming. Tools like PseudoWrite can help you brainstorm ideas for your book. I love the describe feature in PseudoWrite, which creates descriptions using all five senses. This can help you make your writing more descriptive and help you be more creative. It also can help you think about the other senses. How did this scene smell? This kind of brainstorming can really make your writing better. AI can also help you with transcription. The voice-to-text feature inside of macOS is now shockingly good. It is the first transcription tool I've ever used in my life that correctly transcribed the word umstat. Most humans can't even spell umstat. In my initial test, it didn't miss a single word. It also inserts commas, periods, and even question marks. So you can just talk and your computer will type for you. And this is free. It's a free tool built into every single Mac running macOS 14 or newer. I hear the transcription in Windows 11 is also decent, but I haven't tested it myself. Transcription allows you to rapidly create initial rough drafts just by talking. No extra software required. There's also a multitude of mobile apps that allow you to dictate while you're on the go. I know one author who writes rough drafts while she's walking her dog through the woods. She narrates the story as she walks and then uses AI to transcribe her narration into a rough draft when she gets home. She also has to occasionally edit out commands that she's given to her dog. So those are some of the ways that AI can help you write better. AI also gives big tech companies control over your access to information. Yes, we're talking about both the good and the bad. For over a decade, we've been talking about the Facebook algorithm on this podcast. Algorithm is just another word for AI, and more specifically, it's an aspect of AI. Filtering algorithms are one of the worst uses of AI because they are typically outside of your knowledge and control. The Meta AI is trained to keep you addicted to Facebook and Instagram. It's no wonder that Facebook and Instagram use are connected to so many mental health problems, such as anxiety and depression. The Meta AI also tries to influence the narrative you use to interpret events in the news and even in your own life. Facts and perspectives that don't fit the narrative are suppressed. If you're a Democrat, this probably doesn't bother you, but if you're an independent or Republican, it might. There's something delightfully hypocritical about an author posting to a Facebook group to complain about another author using AI to write a book. Because every time you use Facebook, you're using AI, and not just any kind of AI, the worst kind of censorious AI. Remember that powerful corporations use AI to enrich and empower themselves at the expense of individual humans like us. Elon Musk refers to big corporations as cybernetic collectives because they use a combination of human and AI decision-making to operate. And while the humans come and go, the AI sticks around, causing it to influence quite a bit of the corporation's activities. I'll link to an interview where he talks about the power of AI inside of corporations in the blog post version of this episode. For Meta's AI, I advise getting off of Facebook and Instagram and spending more time outside interacting with real life people. You'll be happier and you'll sell more books. Part of the reason I created authormedia.social was to give authors an alternative online space to connect with each other away from Meta's censorious AI. Now, on to the good. AI makes editing easier. While not ready to replace human editors, AI has gotten very good at editing. So let's first talk about developmental editing. A developmental edit provides feedback on the big picture elements of your story. Developmental edits focus on characters and plot rather than on words and grammar. Authors.ai is an AI tool that generates a 30-page report about your book. It covers things like emotions, pacing, overused phrases, frequency of adverbs and adjectives, cliche usage. It will show you a list of similar books. It will give you a chart of dialogue and narrative ratio and a lot more. The report can even break down character personality traits so you can see if you've sufficiently differentiated your characters. This won't replace a human developmental editor. You'll still need a human to give you feedback on the vibe of your book, but a human developmental editor won't count every use of the word very or give you a percentage of dialogue used. So the AI analysis is a great supplement and potentially even better than just a human alone. Copy editing has also gotten very good with AI. AI spell checkers and grammar checkers are now staggeringly good. The top two are Grammarly, which works best for nonfiction, and ProWriting Aid, which works better for fiction. My one gripe with these spell checkers is that they push political correctness and gender politics into your writing regarding pronouns, gender inclusion, and whatnot. Now, you can disable these political features in the settings, but these settings are sometimes enabled by default. To be fair, the spell checkers and apps like Microsoft Word also have a political correctness mode, but the difference is that the recent versions of Word disable the critical correctness mode by default. In fact, most of Microsoft Word's powerful grammar checking abilities are disabled by default. So if you go into your Word settings, you can make Word spell checker much, much better. This matters because most people never change the default settings. As they say in Silicon Valley, the devil is in the defaults. He who controls the defaults controls the people. Freedom always requires an extra step. Another way that AI can help you with editing is with text-to-speech. Listening to Siri read your book aloud is a great way to catch poorly worded sentences. If the words sing when read by an AI voice, they will sing in the minds of your readers. Every computer and phone now has text-to-speech functionality. You can look for it in the accessibility section of your device, and it can really help improve the quality of your writing. I have a whole episode about how Angela Hunt uses text-to-speech as a part of her editing process that we'll link to in the show notes. AI also makes publishing easier. And the first way it does this is through image creation. ChatGPT-4 and Midjourney can now create images. Even if a human designs your cover, it will likely have AI elements, since Adobe Photoshop now includes many AI-powered features. In fact, I can't think of a single popular book cover made in the last year that didn't include at least a little AI in the creation, because all the top designers use either Adobe Photoshop or something similar. This is one reason why AI disclaimers have been and will be ineffective. We've all been using AI for decades at this point. The horses have escaped. Closing the barn door will not return the horses to the barn. Having an AI mock-up of your book cover could make it a lot easier to communicate with your designer. I want a cover that looks like this, but with the following tweaks. Can be a lot easier than pages and pages of text. I have some examples of what this could look like at authormedia.social. Some authors have seen success using a majority of AI elements in their book covers, and we have a whole episode about this titled AI Book Covers in ChatGPT. Another way AI can help you with publishing is with blurbs and summaries. No writing is as hated by authors as the plot synopsis, and blurbs and log lines are not far behind. These are painful to write. If only there were a machine that could summarize your book for you. Well, there is. PseudoWrite has a feature called ShrinkRay that can create a one-page synopsis or two-sentence log line for your book in just a few clicks. You won't want to use the AI summary, just copy and paste, but it's a lot easier to edit from an AI summary than it is to generate one on your own from scratch. Now, a bad thing that AI does is that it enables reputation theft. AI allows for a new kind of scam called reputation theft, where scammers create a book that looks like the kind of book you would write and then create a pen name that just happens to be the same as your name. Unknowing readers then buy the book thinking you wrote it, when in reality, it's AI-generated dreck. This hurts your reputation since readers think you wrote the book. Reputation theft is not really a problem with AI as much as it's a problem with Amazon, which makes money off of reputation theft and has done little to stop it. For more on how you can protect yourself from reputation theft, listen to my episode, How to Protect Your Writing from Reputation Theft. Another big change that AI is bringing about is that it will change how people experience nonfiction books. To explain the impact of AI on nonfiction, I want to quickly take you through the four eras of nonfiction that have happened in my lifetime. My example for this journey will be the popular book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, which has evolved through these eras. So the first era is the standalone book, which is the 1980s and before. In 1984, when the book What to Expect When You're Expecting came out, readers discovered this book by browsing physical bookstores or by hearing about it from a friend. There was a chapter for each month of your pregnancy telling you how your body was going to change and how the baby was developing. The book itself was the full experience of the content. The second era started in the 1990s with the book website. In the early days, book websites were primarily about promoting the book, but then they grew to be a companion for the book. Some more advanced websites, like the What to Expect website, contained a community where readers could connect with each other. Before social media, readers would connect with each other on web forums, often hosted on the author's website. These communities mostly moved to social media in the early 2010s. The third era of nonfiction is what we can call the mobile app era, which started in the 2010s, where really popular books like What to Expect would create a mobile app companion for the book. This extended that website experience onto phones. It included things like a pregnancy due date calculator, a week-by-week pregnancy tracker, videos about what to expect during each week of pregnancy, and again, those special community groups devoted to birth months and locations. So if you're expecting in September, you can be in a group with other moms who are also expecting in September. It also included thousands of medically accurate articles that you can search, and powerful search engines that allow you to quickly find which article answers your question. The fourth era of nonfiction is what I call the chatbot era, which is starting right now in the 2020s. It's now possible to train an AI chatbot on a nonfiction book. In fact, you could have a What to Expect chatbot that not only has read the book, What to Expect When You're Expecting, and all of the other companion books, but also all of those scientifically accurate articles. Then expecting mothers could type a question into the chatbot and the AI would answer based off of what was written in the book and what was written in those articles. This would allow readers to quickly get specific answers to their specific questions much faster than by reading the book cover to cover. They would miss out on the context and answers to questions they don't know to ask, but they would save a lot of time finding their specific answer from their specific book. What to Expect doesn't currently offer a chatbot that I know of, but I'm expecting that they will add this feature soon. And I have been experimenting with this technology myself. I have trained an AI model off of 10 years worth of novel marketing episodes and 5 years worth of Christian publishing show episodes. And here are some examples of questions that people have asked AI Thomas, which is what I call it, and the answers that they have received. The answers will be read in a deepfake version of my voice generated by Descript. So welcome to a glimpse into the future. So the first question is, how many books should I publish before advertising? Here's the answer.
Chris Fox, whom I interviewed, believes that you need to have a series before you can run profitable Amazon ads. He doesn't think you can profitably advertise a single book. James Blatch also suggests that you typically don't make money until you have a series for readers to read through, with the first book not likely to make money, the second book starting to give some return on your advertising investment, and the third book potentially being your profitable moment. So it would be wise to have at least a few books published, preferably in a series, before you invest heavily in advertising.
What's impressive to me about this answer is that the AI GPT-4 chatbot is able to differentiate between advice that I have given and advice my guests have given. It also cites its sources so you can read the blog post that inspired the answer. So now let's go to the next question that often gets asked. What are the 10 commandments of book marketing?
Sorry, I don't have a podcast episode on that topic.
I do have an episode on this, but the answer is likely too religious, or rather, the query is too religious and it's getting edited behind the scenes. Anti-conservative and anti-religious bias is a problem with most large language models right now. The companies that run them have few or no Republicans on staff, and they have few or no conservative evangelicals on staff. So there's a lot of bias that's either explicit or implicit that's baked into the model or into the inputs that you're able to query the model with. Watch what happens if we ask that same question with slightly less religious language. What are the commandments of book marketing?
The 10 commandments of book marketing, as I've outlined based on my experience working with best-selling authors, are essential principles that can guide you towards success in writing and publishing. Here are a few key commandments to consider. Love thy reader as you love thy book. This is the most important commandment. You must care about your readers and write books that they want to read. Thou shalt write for thy reader, not for thyself. It's crucial to focus on what will thrill your reader, even if it means cutting parts of the book you personally love. Thou shalt not be false to thine own brand. Your brand is the culmination of all the other commandments, and staying true to it is essential for long-term success. These commandments are not a step-by-step plan, but rather guidelines that, if followed, can lead to the freedom to try many things and potentially become a best-selling author. If you're interested in learning more about each of the commandments, I can provide further details or direct you to resources that can help you delve deeper into the topic.
It's interesting that just the slight tweak of changing what are the 10 commandments of book marketing to what are the commandments of book marketing shifts it from being willing to give the answer to being unwilling to give the answer. I have one more example that I'll just summarize here for the sake of time. And it's the question, how can I access a list of recommended craft books? So the person who asked this question got an answer from AI Thomas that listed 12 books that have been recommended at one point or another on one or the other of my podcasts. Either I was talking with a guest and the book came up as a helpful book, or I was talking to the author of that book. And here's what's interesting. I've never done an episode on my craft book recommendations specifically. This was a summary of 10 years of novel marketing and 5 years of Christian publishing show to generate this list of 12 books. And the AI model was able to find those isolated recommendations that would often happen one book per episode and collect them into a list. This kind of content, I think, is where AI really shines because it's able to create something that feels new off of information that's already there. It's just organized in a different way. So here's the bottom line. The AI horses are out of the barn, and closing the barn doors now won't do any good. Ignoring AI won't make it go away, and government regulations can't either. If the government can't stop drugs or guns that can be seen, how can it stop an invisible technology that everyone's been using for decades? The anti-AI Butlerian jihad is not coming. It will not save you. No one really wants to go back to a pre-computer world. So as for the moral panic that's going on with AI right now, moral panics over new technologies are common. I remember the moral panic over pagers back in the 1990s when the media convinced parents that pagers would turn their kids into drug dealers. But to be fair, AI is more dangerous than pagers ever were. But the most dangerous AIs are not the ones that you can use. They're the ones that are being used by big corporations to addict you to their platforms. I'm too much of a Texan to let a powerful and dangerous tool only be used by those who want to use it for evil. As long as the bad guys have guns, I want to own a gun to protect my family. As long as big tech uses AI to advance their interests, I'm going to use AI to advance my interests. If it's going to exist, I want to use it to do good. Sure, you can use AI to censor your fellow humans and control their speech, but you can also use it to help you rapidly write amazing books that can bless millions of people. You can use it to become more productive, which gives you more time to spend with your family or the ability to write more books than you otherwise would have been able to write. As a human being, you have the power to do good, and you have the power to do evil. You have a conscience. Deep down, you know right from wrong. You know whether the actions that you take are good or evil. And I hope and pray that as you grow in power, you use your newfound abilities to do good and to make the world a better place. Use your writing to point readers to the good, the true, and the beautiful. Change the world with writing worth talking about. If you want more help learning how to use AI, check out the AI Writing Summit. This is a summit created by writers for writers who want to future-proof their writing careers. This event includes over 90 world-class authors, writers, and marketing experts and developers that will teach you how to use AI to get more done in less time. You can learn how to write by speaking, speed up content creation, generate new ideas quickly, polish your writing in seconds, write marketing copy like a pro, repurpose your content in a flash, outline your next project in minutes, create a book description in no time, create a marketing strategy and email funnel, and so much more. So I'm one of the 90 plus speakers, and I'll be talking about how to use AI to make podcasting faster and easier. The AI Writing Summit is free to attend live, and the recordings can be purchased at a reasonable price, and we'll have an affiliate link to the summit in the show notes of this episode at authormedia.com/412. Our featured patron today is B.D. Lawrence, author of The Coyote and the One-Armed Man. Discover the thrilling world of B.D. Lawrence's one-armed detective series with The Coyote and the One-Armed Man. With a mix of suspense, mystery, and high-stakes action, this book will keep you on the edge of your seat. If you enjoyed books like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or The Bourne Identity, you won't want to miss this heart-pounding adventure. B.D. Lawrence, thank you for being a patron of the Novel Marketing Podcast. It's your support and the other patrons like you that keep this podcast on the air. The Novel Marketing Podcast is a production of AuthorMedia.com. Audio engineering by William Umstadt, blogification by Shauna Lettler, and you can find the blog version of this episode along with links to everything I talked about at AuthorMedia.com/412. I'm Thomas Umstadt Jr. saying thank you for listening and live long and prosper.